For the next 3 hours, it's Open Mind, and I am so delighted you're along because we're here to stretch yours a little bit. Perhaps give your mind something that you haven't thought about in a while. Tonight, we're going to talk about a very basic part of each and every one of us, and that is our spiritual self. Just exactly what is it and how important it is. And our guest tonight is Carrie Williams. Carrie, welcome. Welcome to Open Mind. I'm so delighted to have you here.
I'm delighted to be here, Bill.
Put that little red button. There you go. Say it again.
Hi, I'm delighted to be here with you tonight.
I am delighted to have you here. Carrie has written some books that I think are... Well, you put them in your library. They're in mine. One of them is called The Phoenix Fire Mystery. Let's write that down. And the other one is called Reincarnation, A New Horizon in Science, Religion, and Society. And, of course, we're going to talk about the spiritual part of us that just goes on and on and on. It seems that so many of us have the idea that our physical person here is the most important thing, and our spiritual part of it, the little energy that makes it run, is kind of secondary.
Yes, and many people do think that way at times.
And actually, it should be the other way around. Our physical person is to serve the spiritual person.
According to all of our research.
According to your research. So we're talking research here tonight.
We're talking research into all the world religions.
Mm-hmm.
And indeed all scientific data, which has nothing to do with religion per se, but confirms it.
Mm-hmm.
That what you said is indeed the fact that our physical body and our personality, which many, many people identify with as being the only existence that there is, and that that little divine immortal part of us, whatever name you want to give it, higher self, the soul, spirit, is indeed the real man.
Mm-hmm.
And that this house that houses it is the physical man and the least important of our real being and our experience here on planet Earth.
Well, particularly in this society, let's just call it the Christian Judeo-Society, there is, and I'm oversimplifying here, of course, the idea that we are born, physical and spiritual, we go through one lifetime, and then we cease to exist physically, and when that physical existence ceases, there is a... We go into limbo, we go to heaven.
Yes.
That's the more or less the prevailing
That's
thought.
That's the
here.
Modern thought, Christo Judeo, modern Western idea.
Mm-hmm.
If we go back in history and understand a little of the early Christian thought and the neo... Before that, before Christianity really came into its own, the Neoplatonist school.
Mm-hmm.
In which the early mythology was very well understood, indeed the symbology of what man is and the purpose of life, which seems to have, when Christianity came into being, somehow been lost.
Yeah.
So the title of our book is Reincarnation, A New Horizon, because it's new to some people who have lost the understanding or the thread of truth that has existed since time immemorial. The understanding of ancient African tribes, the Huna in Hawaii, many of what is considered ancient and very primitive is indeed very much the opposite. And some of our exciting research does cite that these people, though they live maybe very simply according to our American and Western standards, are indeed living very close to the real true life. They're living in harmony with the earth. Their understanding of survival and unity and brotherhood is a camaraderie that somehow our American civilization is always at a loss for, or short-sighted.
Mm-hmm.
And we take that to the world and global problems, and we still see it on that level. When we go back to the primitive tribes and we read what they've achieved with their understanding, their symbols and their myths, we can see that it was indeed many of these ancient African or other tribes of the East and the West were indeed very, very profound. And you said it very simply earlier in the beginning of the show that we have this little inner part of us that is very profound, and people say, if it's there, why can't I know it? How do we know it exists? How do we know that we have this, call it consciousness or higher part of ourselves or higher self or inner self, that really does exist and is always operating all the time? Some people say the ability called intuition is a certain application of that inner self applied to daily living. Take it a step further, and you have what we call the great teachers of humanity that are using that full consciousness all the time, every minute of their life, to serve humanity. And when we take this worldly approach in our writing and in our research, we try to show that there were many great teachers who came to help humanity. In the Eastern realm, they're called Mahatmas, great souls. And that Eastern term is very much part of Western civilization today because we've had many gurus coming to America trying to enlighten the Western mind. But what the West has to understand is what we have right here is very profound. If we can just undo the dogma and hear the inner meaning of the words of, let's say, Jesus the Christ, or as you mentioned earlier, the Judeo-Christian doctrines that we have right here in the West, they are very, very magnificent and in harmony with all the world religions.
Well, as you look at the Kabbalah,
yes.
The Kabbalah, of course, is certainly explicit about the reality of reincarnation. As you look at the writings of the early elders of the Christian Church, in particular Origen and St. Augustine,
very,
very specific about the actuality or part of that teaching of reincarnation. And as you look at the world around us, there are more people that seem to understand that life goes on and you don't just get born and go to heaven or hell. I mean, you know, that's a little dull.
It's very frightening.
Yeah.
I think...
Well, that, of course, is... I always say that the burden of proof is on the detractors, and it's the only detraction I've ever heard that this isn't so, because I don't read that in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John.
Yes.
But they've never gone down and gotten into the original text of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John and the rest of it. And by the way, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John had some very profound things to say about the eternal spirit.
You are very indeed correct. And we do cite many instances that have appeared. Many people take it as dual meaning. Those who seek not to believe in the idea of reincarnation say that those who are reincarnationists have misinterpreted, read into it. And those who choose to ignore the fact that such a possibility exists say it isn't what the teachings say as far as Christianity. We don't like to argue. We like to take this, since this show is called The Open Mind.
Yes, sir.
That we hope listeners will take an open mind and try to understand maybe some of these ideas that are universal in nature.
Well, I wanted to touch upon the religious aspects that we're around for just a minute, because most people equate their responsibility towards spirituality in a religious sense.
Yes.
They get involved in some kind of a religion, which is to, in some way, pay homage to their spiritual growth. And indeed,
yes,
Religions were designed to do that. However, we find that most religions allow you to grow spiritually, provided you do certain ceremonies, do some rote,
yeah,
and that sort of thing, dogma.
Right. When you say pay homage, you know, I often wonder, the largest institution in the Western world today is the Roman Catholic Church. And it's paying homage in indeed a very specific monetary way. Spirituality and going through the motions of going to church or going to temple or going to a Buddhist monastery, whatever religion or faith anyone may be, does not guarantee that you are going to be indeed spiritual or awaken the spiritual part of your nature.
I always say that it's a cop-out. If you do certain pieces of ceremony and certain pieces of rote and perform certain functions, a lot of people said, hey, I have done that, I have worn my cap, I have done this, I have been there, I have done the beads, and so therefore I have done my spiritual thing, and then I can go on and do whatever I want to, because I've done my spiritual thing.
Well, my question
is, the evolvement of spirituality is a never-ending quest.
As I walk down the street every day, I ask myself, if all these people are indeed doing, as you say, going to their places of worship, following the ceremonies to the letter, Going to church, going to temple, paying your dues, saying your prayers, doing the worship, idol worships in India, whatever it is, then why don't we have millions of great humanitarian teachers here on earth right now? If everybody is achieving spiritual development, why can't we see it?
Why is it that man's inhumanity to man at this point in time has never been greater than it is now? We're not going to count the 38 or 40 wars that are going on.
I understand.
Battlefield wars. We're going to talk about also the wars that go on within the shimmering skyscrapers of Los Angeles and Chicago and New York among those people there.
Well, it's an interesting way of
putting
it.
And all around it.
The man's inhumanity, the man...
has never been greater.
Well, we have very many people here in existence, in incarnation right now, in a body, experiencing something. And it's really interesting that all the great religions of the world are all predicting something to be happening at this period in our evolution. Always, all the religions, whether it's Christianity waiting for the return of Christ or the second coming or whatever it may be, something critical is occurring on our planet
toward
now.
The end of this century.
Right. Psychics are predicting it.
Well, it's certainly a part of the litany of the Christian writings that something would happen at about this time.
But it isn't only the Christian writing.
But also, it coincides with a lot of other writings.
Exactly.
But it certainly came up in the teachings of Jesus and in the teachings of John, as found in Revelations, that we're approaching a critical time.
But there are many cycles.
The Hopi Indians certainly have some very, very interesting things to say. And now John Voight has been working very closely with them. There's kind of an amassing of things that are happening with the Hopis. And we hope to have John and the Hopis on here in the next couple of weeks if we can get them all settled down at one time and talk about what that very pristine and spiritual group of people have to say.
It's interesting. There was a special on the other day in which the Easter Islanders were found to be linked to the Ashkenazi Indians, and that they were indeed a carryover from the Eastern Islanders, because many of their teachings, their symbolical drawings and etchings, and the teachings that they offer themselves are indeed one and the same. I think that from one part of the United States to the other, you know, there's this thread of truth that prevails.
Well, it's kind of a fascinating thing. So we do kind of, maybe we step on some people's toes, but we're not here to step on your toes. We're here to put something on the table for you to discuss, for you to think about, because there's a lot more to what's going on than heaven and hell in your life.
Yes.
And in your afterlife and your pre-life.
Yes, I'd like to tell a little story here, not to the British Prime Minister David Lloyd George. People fear going to hell, but his fear was a perpetual heaven, which is a different way of looking at things. And I think his own words stand to reason. You know, they offer an understanding that, said in his words, are awakening to many minds. He said, "When I was a boy, the thought of heaven used to frighten me more than the thought of hell. I pictured heaven as a place where there would be perpetual Sundays with perpetual services, from which there would be no escape, as the Almighty, assisted by cohorts of angels, would always be on the lookouts for those who did not attend. It was a horrible nightmare. The conventional heaven with its angels perpetually singing nearly drove me mad in my youth and made me an atheist for 10 years. My opinion is that we shall be reincarnated." Now, people think of heaven today as a glorified place to be, or what is portrayed as being a heavenly state, when indeed a lot of our research, and we do go into it quite thoroughly, of people who have had near-death experiences and what they experience in these after-death states indicates quite a revelation that people need to understand.
And the out-of-body travelers are also telling us a whole new set of things that you have to deal with.
Well, a lot of people who travel who have out-of-body experiences that are not near-death experiences, we don't really cover. We only cover those that are documented near-death experiences.
Those are the near-death. But I go through the body of evidence that comes from the Monroe Institute of Applied Sciences, Robert Monroe and his group. This is a very concerted scientific group of people?
I must say that he was the one who did the research with Elizabeth Kubler-Ross.
Right.
Who I'm happy to say wrote the introduction to Reincarnation, the Phoenix Fire Mystery, which is now available again in paperback. And what she experienced out of all the people that were there, she's the only one who had an out-of-body experience induced. And that's where she experienced the concept of Shanti Nilayat, final home of peace. And her life work and her goal, indeed today, is to help people achieve that peace. Dying people.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's
she
dying children
with
AIDS. And she's done more for humanity to help people not be afraid of death than anyone else I know. And in the beginning of our book, in The New Horizon, we constantly bring up this issue because many, many young people today are in a critical state of disillusionment of living.
Mm-hmm.
Suicides are rampant among elementary school children.
Drug use
and abuse. Family abuse.
Well, using a drug is abuse.
Yes, right, it is. But to the point, I mean, of overdosing.
Yeah.
But what we have found in a lot of the research, and such gentlemen as Viktor Frankl and other psychologists today, said there's nothing greater at the root or cause of all the psychoses and neuroses of the world today. It stems from one thing only, is the conclusion, and that's the fear of death. And that's why I attribute Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's work as being very great for our humanity, because she's helped people overcome the fear of death. She experienced at Monroe what it feels like to die.
Mm-hmm.
That was part of her repertoire of that experience there. And because of that, she has taken that work to help people understand death as a process, as a transition, not as an end. It's only an end to, as you said earlier, the shell, the physical body.
This little space that we have to live in.
Yes, it's quite bulky.
Yes, very restricted.
Yes.
Sometimes
but
it hurts.
Yes, for some people. Yes, it's true. There are some people that I've met along the way in this work that have said they remember being born.
Hmm?
They remember being born. And at the time of birth, they remember what a horror it was to try to move around this heavy body. Because they also could remember what it was like to be free of a body.
And not have it at all.
Right. Right before birth and before conception.
And I've talked to some who remember the conversations that their mother had while they were in the womb.
Yes.
And interestingly enough, going back even before they had ears.
Yes.
That they could understand this.
Well.
I think the fact that the sperm and the egg get together and all at once a magical thing happens. A master electrician, a master chemist, a master biologist, a master of many disciplines goes to work and makes this little body. And it was not mother. And all she did was provide the raw materials in the safe place. And it was not God, necessarily. It was the spiritual intelligence that took advantage of that moment.
Yes, but evolution or creation, let's say, happens on two levels. The physical body has to be made.
Mm-hmm.
Mother and father are important in the contributing.
Well, certainly, they put all of these little elements
right,
together.
Right, they put the elements together. But then, on the more refined or ethereal level, is the soul coming to inhabit that body.
That's where the intelligence is.
Exactly, because many researchers have found now, and it's been said in varied bodies of knowledge, that there is an agreement between the mother, the father, and the future, what's called incarnating ego. That part of us that is immortal, that never dies, that experiences and learns and retains the essence of the experience
right.
to go on. And all of that is a part of us now.
Well, sometimes the sperm and the egg get together and there's no life.
Yes.
Because there was no intelligence that decided to take advantage of that moment.
Or it did and it didn't happen. The opportunity
happen
wasn't right. We found a very interesting story that was written about a young little boy that died, Eduardo. I don't know if you remembered, about 1977, 78. He said he didn't know why he chose a sick body to come into this life. But he did know that dying was only a transition. And that he had a special mission here. And his mother, ever since this child was very young, had to take him to the Eastern schools. He was a Buddhist, and he understood the precepts and the tenets. And when he was taken to a Buddhist monastery, they recognized him as being a great soul. And he made a tape recording before he died, and he told people to not be afraid, that if they could let go of their attachment to this physical body, which we think all life is, it's just this...
Yeah, is this all there is? You know,
two arms, two legs.
Yeah.
And to let go that there was something far greater beyond. The thing is, we get a glimpse of death every single night.
Mm-hmm.
And we can take the smaller example of our waking-sleeping cycle and deep sleep and compare that to living and dying and being reborn. We get to practice this lesson every night of our life as long as we have this body. And people, you know, they wonder, why can't we remember who we were? Indeed, we are everything that we ever thought. We are a composite of all of our thoughts, actions, and deeds. Everything we've experienced in all of our past lives.
And who knows how long that has been?
According to the secret doctrine written by Blavatsky, the average is, average incarnation, between incarnations is 5,000 years. Average. Some of us have been here thousands of times already. And, of course, in the dating of the planet Earth is always in question at this time. But we've all lived many, many times before.
We didn't have to always live on planet Earth, you know.
No. But the only volume or information that I know that deals with that issue, and it only deals with the evolution of this planet Earth, is The Secret Doctrine, written by Blavatsky.
Yeah, that's a must book for everybody's...
Well, Einstein read it and studied it thoroughly, and was doing some research in which an article was written up in Santa Barbara in which he it was stated that one of his comments he had to write to Niels Bohr and said, if you have any questions that you can't solve, just flip over The Secret Doctrine. You're bound to find the answer.
There's something in her, in her work. My guest tonight is Kerry Williams. Obviously, we're talking about reincarnation. She's written two books on it, Reincarnation, A New Horizon in Science, Religion, and Society. And the other one is The Phoenix Fire Mystery. Very, very provocative things for you to read. Let me give you the numbers if you'd like to talk to Kerry. Has written a book herself, or is a co-author of a book called Reincarnation, A New Horizon in Science, Religion, and Society. And then there is Reincarnation, The Phoenix Fire Mystery. I said that you wrote that, but you didn't write that, did you?
No, my co-author is Sylvia Cranston, and she's worked on three prior works, Reincarnation and World Thought, Reincarnation East-West Anthology, Reincarnation... The Phoenix Fire Mystery, and then as with her co-author Joseph Head,
uh-huh.
And I became a new member of the team with Reincarnation, A New Horizon.
All right, so...
I just wanted people to understand...
Let's get it
there's
straight.
There's been many, many years of research.
We don't want to give you a book you haven't written.
Yeah.
Exactly, yourself. Okay, let's go to our callers and see what they have on their mind. Warren, you're on.
Hi. I had a couple of questions, and before I posed the questions, I wanted to see if we agreed on a couple of precepts. One, that words create and thoughts create. Could we agree on that?
Okay, can I add to that a little bit?
Sure.
The co-founder of the Theosophical Movement was William Pugh Judge, and he said a very profound statement that I like very much, and I'd like to share that with you. He said, use with living care those living messengers called words. So does that indeed mean we are in agreement?
Yes, it does.
Well, we do know that the a thought is in the virtual state.
Yes.
That the thought is energy.
Yes.
And you create energy with your thoughts.
Yes.
And, of course, words are preceded by thoughts.
Well, words, there are thoughts, not only thoughts, but vibration of sound, which is also another form of energy.
So your great task in life is to make sure that your thoughts are in harmony with the universe.
Yes.
Okay.
That's exactly correct.
Okay, so the concept behind the music of the spheres in Pythagoras.
Yes.
All right. And the questions that I have deal with not a disagreement in anything you say about reincarnation, but a query, as it were. When you're done with what you described as your spiritual thing, what next? My problem is, you know, when we talked about organized religion, you understood that they had all their rituals and everything else. In dealing with New Age thought, as it is, what I see happening is there are also, like Blavatsky, and theosophy, schools of thought that supposedly or purportedly teach people how to deal with a separate reality. Whether it's Carlos Castaneda or Blavatsky doesn't really matter. What I don't really hear anybody talking about is the fact that even when the whole journey is done, when you come really back to it, he realized that the ultimate teacher was always the self. And what I don't hear anybody saying is that that ultimate teacher being the self is always there, and it takes the quiet time to understand that. And it's too proselytized or bastardized that you need a guru. And it's not true.
It is absolutely not true. You get 5 stars in my book, Warren, on that one, for whatever that is worth.
No, we're both in agreement with you here tonight. The self, as you said, is what has been called the self. Let's clarify it for people who may not understand what we understand, and that is that the self is the divine, immortal part to our nature. The self is an individuality, is never really finished with experience. It is an endless stream of existence and experience, a cyclic coming and going, coming into a body, coming into a world, and then periods of rest on the single individual level, like I said, at night, on the life level, death, and then on a global planetary level, what's been called in the Eastern parlance, let's say, a manvantara, great period of time in which there's a manifestation of Earths and globes and all types of life forms, and then there's a period of rest on that great and grand level. But the self always is, even during those periods of rest. It never ends. And that's a concept that people can't or may have a very hard time understanding, that, as Einstein said, distance and time and space are forever in the eternal now. The only place that time exists in a linear fashion is on the physical plane here on planet Earth. And then when you're not attached to the physical plane or with yourself uninhibited by a physical body or in the after-death states or whatever name you want to call that state, we are completely in tune with all that there is to know, all the knowledge of the universe. People can experience that, as you said, in quiet times. The concept of meditation is truly an individualized experience that has to be done alone, but not meditating on a candle or meditating on I want to levitate off the ground, but indeed focusing your concentration on the aspect of you that is divine.
I do it in a car.
That we are divine individuals that have a potential that we have barely tapped, and we can get to know that. And in that sense, we are our own teachers. It's the Eastern, let's say, gurus or whatever that have come to the West and tried to tell Americans or the Western mind that they need a teacher. Many, many people believe that. But what's happening today is many, many of those gurus that have came flooding in from India to America are slowly waning away. And eventually, we all have to find out that we have to make our choices, that we are responsible for every choice and decision we make, and that indeed what's called the law of karma will be operating. It's a law of equilibrium. It seeks to establish balance and harmony. Just like you said, the harmony of the spheres, we have to be in harmony with the 7 principles or 10 principles, depending upon what body of knowledge you want to read, that compose our being.
Okay.
Sometimes whenever you look to a guru, or whether he's a Christian guru or a Western guru or whatever, what you're doing is copping out and assigning the responsibility you have for your own spiritual involvement to somebody else, which is nothing more than a cop-out.
Well, sometimes cop-out is a little harsh.
I use harsh words every now and then.
Yes, we try not to be so harsh, because there are a lot of people who have searched, found a teacher of some sort, whatever name you want to give it, have learned a lesson, has learn something that they could take away with them, and moved on.
Well, that's the idea. You need to be taught, or you need... But there's a lot of teaching that happens.
Yes.
Could I interject one thing?
Sure, please do.
I'm in agreement with you on all points, except when people have found a guru, whatever background they might come from, and when they give them something that is spiritually correct and they take them to another step, I believe in a sense that's also harmful, in that it takes them again to the next point that they've got to go outside of themselves to find someone to show them how to find out who they are.
Okay, let's...
Now, I don't have the answer. I'm not trying to pretend that I do.
But let's say that no one really takes anyone anywhere. People can explain something. People can tell you to read something. People can tell you to chant up and down and stand on your head. It's up to the individual to go through the motions and do the effort on their own. If they have an experience because someone told them to do something, they earn the experience themselves.
I'm in agreement, but why I ask for the agreement on the precept that words are thoughts and thoughts create is in that when you accept the reality of the guru in its constant state, just the fact of the guru, you negate the self. And that may be an extreme point.
I understand what you're saying, but in actuality...
And how do you overcome the fact...